Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today is Veterans Day, and it, like so much else, seems to take on special significance this year in the midst of our global pandemic and now a rocky presidential transition. Here is a bit of Governor Charlie Baker speaking as part of the state's virtual Veterans Day ceremony earlier today.
I think in some respects, the most important thing I can say about Veterans Day is it gives us all a chance to reflect for a minute on what our freedoms, our democracy, mean to us. We would not be Americans. We would not have the kinds of rights and liberties and opportunities that we have in this country of ours if it weren't for the men and women in uniform, past, present, and future.
Congressman Seth Moulton of the 6th District is with us to help commemorate the day and reflect on what's different this year. The congressman served 4 tours in Iraq as a U.S. Marine and last week won re-election to his seat. Congressman, congratulations on the election win and welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's great to be here.
I know you hold an annual Veterans Day town hall. I understand it'll be virtual this year like so many other things are. Who will participate, Congressman, and what do you expect to hear from them tonight?
Well, we have an amazing lineup of veterans who are each going to share a short story of their service and how it's impacted them here at home, a little bit about what they did overseas and maybe how it's changed their lives ever since. But the real goal is to bridge the divide between veterans and everybody else. So what we're hoping is a lot of non-veterans will tune in to listen and learn a little bit about veterans and their service.
How do you characterize that divide? What is the divide between veterans and everyone else?
Well, you know, it's been different at different times in our history. Obviously, many were alive during Vietnam when it was a bitter divide, and veterans weren't appreciated for their service, even though many volunteered just to go, so no one had to go in their place. We have unpopular wars these days as well, but I can certainly speak for myself. I've always felt appreciated for my service, but not always understood. And I meet a lot of people who say, I love veterans, I want to help, but I don't even know where to start because I just don't get what being a veteran is all about, and I don't know what I can do to help veterans when they get back home. So the idea of this town hall is to help connect veterans and non-veterans, veterans with the communities that they fought to protect and serve. The idea was really popularized by Sebastian Younger, the author of Perfect Storm, right. Tribe, War, who did the first Veterans Town Hall with me in Marblehead a few years ago. But now it's expanded nationwide, and it's become a very popular event that we hope will turn into a national tradition.
Let's stick with this idea, that you brought up a moment ago of understanding. The pandemic, we know that it's affected different populations in really profoundly different ways. What about veterans? You know, the tragic deaths at the Holyoke Soldiers Home come to mind for me immediately, but what should we understand about the pandemic and how it has affected veterans?
Well, first of all, I think veterans deserve the best healthcare in the world. And yet, as we saw, as came to light with the disaster in Holyoke, they're clearly not getting it. Now, many of us have known for a while that the VA has some problems. In fact, I made a commitment to continue getting my own health care at the VA after I was elected, just because I said, look, as long as my fellow veterans are going there, then I'm going to go there too and see it firsthand as a member of Congress. And we know that VA care across the country is spotty, and we have work to do. I mean, frankly, health care for a lot of Americans is spotty, and all of that's been highlighted by this pandemic. Those who have the fewest resources often get the worst health care. And that's not right when health care should simply be a human right that all of us enjoy. So I'd say that's the first thing about the pandemic, is it's really, really highlighted the disparities in care. Why shouldn't veterans get the best health care in the world? Look at what they've done for us, right? The second thing I'd say is that, you know, a lot of veterans come back with invisible wounds of war, post-traumatic stress, as I've admitted publicly I've had to deal with in the past. And mental health issues have been truly exacerbated by this pandemic, not just for veterans, but for all Americans. And that's a place where we do need to do a lot more work. I was very proud to pass a bill to recently designate a 3-digit national mental health hotline so that in the near future, everyone will know exactly what number to call if they need to talk to someone. This will save a lot of lives for veterans and non-veterans alike. But the fact that it's taken so long to get a bill like that passed, to get a simple resource like that widely available to all Americans, just shows how much we need to do to improve access to mental health care in particular. And once we do that, it will make a big difference in many veterans' lives.
Let's talk about the day itself for a minute. I mentioned at the top, you are a former Marine who served 4 tours in Iraq. What does Veterans Day mean to you personally?
As a proud Marine, I have to jump in and say I'm a Marine veteran. Once a Marine, always a Marine. So we try not to say former Marine. But
fair enough.
Look,
that's good to know.
Veterans Day is powerful every single year. It's a time when we veterans really try to reconnect with fellow veterans, some that we served with and know very well, but may live in different parts of the country or the world and be out of touch with, or sometimes just veterans in our communities that maybe we didn't serve with, maybe they're from a different generation or a different war. But every single year on Veterans Day, it's a time to come together and recognize the bond that we have in having worn the uniform of our country. And of course, we're not going to get to do that this year. It's just not simply is not the same meeting up online or on a Facebook group as it is being able to share a drink or break some bread in person. So a lot of veterans are going to feel lonely this year. And that's what I'm worried about in particular. Many veterans are lonely to begin with because perhaps they're in a place like the Holyoke Soldiers Home. Perhaps they don't have family or they don't have a fellow veteran to connect with when they're thinking about their time in the service. And so this year is going to be especially hard. And that's why we're trying to let everyone know that this town hall tonight at 7 o'clock, 7 p.m., you can find the link on my at Rep. Seth Moulton Facebook page, at Rep. Moulton Facebook page. It'll be an opportunity to just listen and connect with some fellow veterans and recognize that if you're someone who's out there feeling lonely and doesn't have anyone to talk to about your service today, well, there are other people out there too.
And we will try to link to that on our webpage at radioboston.org as well. You're a sitting congressman. I do want to talk about the election, which happened, last week, but we still have, we have a president who is refusing to accept the results and has not conceded. And I want to play some sound yesterday from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo for you.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right. We're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly. The world should have every confidence that the transition necessary to make sure that the State Department is functional today, successful today, and successful with the president who's in office on January 20th, a minute after noon, will also be successful.
Now, I want to note there are some who have said that that was a tongue-in-cheek reference to a second Trump administration, but words have impact, and you ran for the office of president with an eye towards national security. What is your reaction to that and to the administration's position over the last several days?
I think it's despicable and it's dangerous. It's dangerous because it's a terrible precedent to set for the rest of the world. And let's not forget, there are young men and women risking their lives out there today, all around the globe, fighting fundamentally for our democratic values and trying to extend those values to other people in the world who lack the freedoms that we enjoy in America. And the Secretary of State just made their job a lot harder, undermined our American credibility, undermined the fundamental values that have always made our nation an example of democratic freedoms to the world. That's why it's dangerous. That's why this is dangerous. It's not a time for tongue-in-cheek moments, whether that was what it is or it wasn't. from the Secretary of State. And it's also important to point out that this is unprecedented. We live in a country that was torn apart by a civil war. And even during the Civil War, we did not have a problem with the peaceful transition of power. Look, you can like some of the things that Trump stands for or not. I certainly don't. But when he just cuts to the heart of what makes us Americans, there's nothing more unpatriotic than that. And it is truly dangerous for our country. It's dangerous for our national security. And I hope some people in the administration today will recognize that it's dangerous for our troops.
Very few of your Republican colleagues in Congress have encouraged the president to accept the results, have congratulated President-elect Joe Biden. What is your message to them?
Find some political courage and find some patriotism. Do the right thing for your country, not for your partisan politics. That's what we all need to do. And it's important to point out that there are some staunch Republicans who have done the right thing, like former President George W. Bush. Now, I served 4 tours under him in Iraq. I didn't vote for him twice. I was highly critical of the war he started. But I never questioned his fundamental patriotism, his fundamental commitment to the troops. This is very different, Tiziana. This is very different with Trump. We've never had a commander-in-chief who thinks that those of us who put on the uniform are suckers, and those who die because they put on the uniform are losers. You know, once again, you can like Trump and his tweets or not, but just understand that that's who the commander-in-chief is. That's who's supposed to be leading our troops. And no matter what your politics, we want a commander-in-chief who represents our values.
In our last 30 seconds or so, I really can hear the urgency in your voice. What are your next steps as a congressman over the next several days?
I'm trying to reach out to my Republican colleagues and encourage them to do the right thing. And I recognize that Trump has made the politics of this difficult for them. But this is so much bigger than politics. And hopefully they'll take a moment on this Veterans Day to recognize that there's much more at stake here than pure politics. We've got to do the right thing for our country, just as so many veterans throughout our history have been willing to do for us.
That's Congressman Seth Moulton, who served 4 tours as a U.S. Marine in Iraq and now represents Massachusetts' 6th District. Congressman, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And listeners, we will post a link to the Congressman's 7 p.m. Veteran Town Hall tonight on our website at radioboston.org. 1 million people are struggling to get enough to eat in Massachusetts. The hunger rate is up 59% since 2018, and 1 in 5 of the Commonwealth's children are food insecure, 1 in 5. Those numbers are from Feeding America, a national nonprofit and network of over 200 food banks. The pandemic has, of course, exacerbated all aspects of hunger here, from the need to the logistics of meeting that need around the state. A little later, we will talk with Congressman Jim McGovern about federal policy as it affects hunger and food aid. But first, let's get an on-the-ground look at serving those who need food support. Andrew Morehouse is the executive director of the Western Massachusetts Food Bank, and Norris Guscott runs Lynn's Food Security Task Force and is the director of Lynn's Food and Fitness Alliance. Andrew and Norris, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Norris, let's start with you. And I want to define the term for people. What does it mean for a family to be food insecure?
It's a great opening question. So food insecurity is defined as not having access to enough healthy, affordable food. So that's going to look different from area to area, state to state. In Lynn in particular, that's tied to socioeconomics. So that's how much money have I got to purchase food? Can I easily get to where they're selling this food? And do I know what foods I need to nourish myself or my family?
And Andrew, you've been running the Western Massachusetts Food Bank since 2005. I ran an organization with a network of food pantries during the Great Recession. I remember how overwhelming the surge in need was in those early days. Can you compare then to now?
Sure, I could do my best. It seems like that was eons ago, given what we're what we've been going through. But my recollection is that, you know, that was almost like a drip Great Recession. It didn't happen or it didn't affect individuals overnight. It took time. So we had the opportunity and the resources to address it as it unfolded. Whereas in the case of COVID-19, you know, there was just such a sudden spike in food insecurity associated with the onset of COVID-19 across our Commonwealth that it created a lot of chaos. We just really weren't ready to respond to such a dramatic increase in food insecurity and at the same time an outpouring of interest in, to support our efforts and get food out to people in unusual ways because our normal way of distributing food had been disrupted due to the health concerns that people faced.
Did you ever expect to see a 1 million number?
Well, let's be clear here that this is a projection of 1 million by the end of the year and into the winter months, really. So it's yet to be borne out, but thus far, all numbers are trending in that direction. So it's sobering indeed. And no, I never expected the numbers to be so here in Western Massachusetts that those ratios are actually 1 in 4 children in Western Mass. So, you know, it's extremely challenging and people are struggling immensely with unimaginable anxiety and stress. And there's nothing more they can do than to reach out to the community for support. And our job is to provide food assistance at the moment to whomever needs it. And that's what we intend to do.
Norris, let me turn back to you. The needs of rural and urban communities vary. The Feeding America report pointed out that Eastern Massachusetts has seen a higher increase in food insecurity than Western Massachusetts has. Tell us, who is hungry in Lynn today?
So to get a picture of who's hungry, I'd like to give some statistics. So My Brother's Table, which is an organization within the Food Security Task Force in the city, My Brother's Table has served 86,000 meals, 4 times more than the 17,000 meals served in June 2019. And a similar spike was seen this past May when 70,000 meals were served compared to the 17,000 during the same month last year. And more meals were served during the month of June than during the entire year 2 decades ago. So we can see that when we say who's hungry, those are folks who have recently lost their jobs. Those are, you know, COVID-19 positive families. Those are the individuals who have always relied on, you know, food resources. You know, there have always been some issues within the food system, and this pandemic has exposed that, not just in Mass, but the U.S. as a whole. And this is an opportunity to permanently address some of the glaring shortfalls in the food system. So that's when everyone is hungry, to answer the question simply.
I want to play a cut here for you, some sound here for you from Fania Alvarez, who works with the Greater Boston Nazarene Compassionate Center in Mattapan. Here she is.
People been calling us, like, kind of really, like, begging for the food. You know, some people, they are unable to come to our pantry because we open Wednesdays and Fridays. But what I can say is we're doing a great work. We're doing a very, very awesome job, but it's a challenge for all of us.
I want to ask both of you, and Norris, you can answer first, and then I'll turn to Andrew. How much are you underserving what the demand is? You know, are you able to provide all the food everyone needs, or what is that gap right now?
So we can always do better, but as of now, I'm speaking for the city of Lynn, we are in a position where we have strong robust support safety nets in terms of food insecurity. So when we're looking at the sudden demand and the sudden spike, yes, that is an issue. And I believe Andrew was alluding to this earlier. There's a massive spike, and for the longest time we were in what I like to call COVID-19 response mode, whereas, you know, we were being pounded by requests and increased demands for food. But as things have stabilized a bit more, as we've seen how COVID is impacting the food system, we've came up with different interventions and methods to keep those safety nets robust and strong. But it is an ongoing, it's an issue that you always have to keep a constant lookout for, because just like that, you know, something in the supply chain could be lost, or, you know, you're having a difficulty getting that for your food pantry, and that exacerbates a need. So as of now, we're okay, but that requires constant vigilance.
Is that true for you in Western Massachusetts as well, Andrew, that you're able to scale up to meet the demand of today?
That's exactly what our modus operandi was over the course of the summer in the aftermath of the disruptions to our supply chains, mainly in the private food industry side. But as the funding for food from the federal and state governments kicked in and eventually began arriving at our food bank in July. To date, we've managed, I believe, to meet the demand for food assistance. You know, we're kind of like the phrase, supply side economics. If you make the goods available, they'll take it, and they'll take everything you have. All the food that we distribute is well received, and if we were to receive more, I'm sure we could distribute more, because there are more people out there than we know of who are in need of food assistance
I think that was my question for both of you, and Andrew, I guess I'll turn to you first. I have to admit, I would think that we are, with the kind of scale of hunger that we're talking about and what we know about nonprofit resources, government funding, physical capacity with volunteers, et cetera, that you'd almost never be able to give everyone all the food they need at this level of hunger. What am I missing?
Well, yeah, that's the $64,000 question, and we don't know. This is a very imperfect system that we've created in the United States of America, a puzzle of charitable hunger response or food insecurity response coupled with public sector supports at all levels, local, state, and federal, and just a plethora of federal nutrition programs that all kind of intersect to try to meet this the need at the moment. During crises like this, I guess our biggest concern is that now that federal funding has pretty much ended for food for this fiscal year without a new budget and no economic stimulus package in sight, at least until after the inauguration, we're concerned about that, as we are about state funding. Between the two, state and federal funding, that represents about half of our food inventory. So if anything, we need to get that secured, and ideally we need an increase in order to meet the demand that's out there. But we'll never know if we're really meeting the full demand. I know Congressman McGovern will speak about the SNAP program, because for every every meal that we provide collectively, the 200 food banks across the entire country, the federal SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, provides 9 meals. So it clearly dwarfs anything that we could possibly do. And without it, we'd be overrun. We don't have a perfect system. We're doing the best we can with the resources that we possess, but we need more for sure.
And Norris, are you able to provide the variety of food, the level of nutrition, fresh as well as prepackaged, culturally appropriate? Are you able to provide that range of food, or are you limited now in what you're able to distribute in Lynn?
So, good question. So I can say that we are going to try. As Andrew was alluding to, food insecurity is a moving issue. It takes many different forms. For example, you touched upon an issue of, you know, culturally relevant produce. You know, given Lynn, you know, it's a high immigrant population, you know, that is an issue. And we were talking about, you know, areas of food insecurity. And so going back, are we able to do so? We are trying. And I say we are trying because it's next to impossible to predict what issue is going to come about. But we are going to meet that need over the best we can. And when we talk about how a solution to the problem, I think we should go on, or we should look to what we've learned. And in my opinion, the challenges that have emerged during the crisis tells us that though our food system in mass is resilient, there are still some areas that we must address. We have to aim to purchase as much produce locally as much as possible and reduce the amount of produce that we're shipping in. You know, that's for supply chain, public health, and economic reasons. We have to ensure that fresh, healthy food is accessible, affordable, and equitable as well. We need to start funding initiatives and policies and interventions that actually looks at healthy food access as we do healthcare and medicine, a necessity for long life. So I'm hoping we can take those lessons that we've learned and try to, hopefully that will guide us to the answer or the solution to this.
That's Norris Guscott, who runs Lynn's First Food Security Task Force and is director of Lynn's Food and Fitness Alliance, and Andrew Morehouse, executive director of the Western Massachusetts Food Bank. I appreciate your time, both of you, today. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day. Bye.
So as we just heard from Andrew Morehouse, federal policy can have a significant impact on hunger, our capacity to address it, the way people experience it. We want to turn now then to Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts' 2nd Congressional District. He is a co-chair of the House Hunger Caucus and won re-election to his seat last week. Congressman, congratulations on your election and welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
So you have spent your legislative career working on hunger. When you hear the kinds of numbers that Feeding America is talking about, a million people food insecure, up to 1 in 5 children, nearly 60% increase in hunger in 2 years, how does that hit you? How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel ashamed. I mean, we live in the richest country in the history of the world, and we have you know, tens of millions of people who are hungry. And, you know, we had a hunger problem well before this pandemic. But this pandemic just blew the lid off of the crisis and is forcing us to reckon with the fact that we have a hunger crisis in America that needs to be addressed. And as I tell people all the time, hunger is a political condition. We have the money. We have the resources. We have the know-how and the infrastructure. What we do not have is the political will. And that has to change for us to be able to solve this crisis.
And are we just not keeping up, or are we moving backward?
Well, I think we're moving backwards, and we've been moving backwards for quite some time. Look, you know, I heard Andrew Morehouse and Norris talked about SNAP, you know, which is our, you know, premier anti-hunger program at the federal level. Well, the average SNAP benefit is about $1.40 per person per meal. I mean, you can't even buy a Dunkin' Donuts coffee for that. And so people who are on SNAP end up having to rely on food banks and food pantries and other charitable organizations to be able to feed themselves or their families through the month. I mean, we ought to have a system where no one has to worry about food. Food ought to be viewed as a fundamental human right, and for some reason it isn't. And the implications of not dealing with this issue, it's not just that people are hungry. It has... it has unintended health consequences. Kids who are hungry can't learn in school. That school meal is vital. It's every bit as important to that child's ability to learn as a textbook. People who are hungry in the workplace are less productive. And by the way, let's put an end to this myth that somehow hunger is just a problem for people who are homeless. It is a problem for those who are homeless. It is a problem for those who are jobless. It is a problem for those who are in jobs that don't pay a livable wage. And that's tens of millions of people. The majority of people on SNAP right now who are able to work actually do work, but they earn so little they still qualify for the benefit.
So you said a minute ago we need a system where no one has to be hungry. How do we do that? What's the difference between where we are policy-wise today and being at a point where we did have that system in place?
Yeah, well, we actually started making progress to eradicating hunger in the late 1970s. And then, when Ronald Reagan became president and our politics took a sharp turn to the right, it became fashionable to diminish the plight of those who were struggling, those who were poor. And even today, if you listen to any of the debates on the SNAP budget in Congress, it really is disturbing because, one, it doesn't reflect reality, but two, it's all about bashing people who are struggling. And so, we have to, as I said before, this is a political condition, and we have to change that. I hope the next president of the United States will take it upon himself to do a White House conference on food, nutrition, and hunger, because to solve this problem, it's not just about increasing the SNAP benefit, although that's part of the way to do it. It involves, a number of things. And so we need to look at this more holistically, not just program by program by program, but more holistically, and get everybody who has a stake in this, by the way, including our medical profession, our doctors and our hospitals, because this is a health issue, too. We need to get them all in a room, and we need to figure out a holistic, comprehensive plan to be able to end this scourge once and for all.
In the short term, given where the elections have turned out, what is still in limbo, et cetera, what are the hopes of getting a financial stimulus package passed in the short term that would address at least some of the needs that are spiking as a result of the pandemic?
Well, as you know, in the House, we passed the HEROES Act over six months ago, which would have addressed some of the issues that we're talking about here today. My hope is that when we go back into session next week, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will finally want to come to the table, and let's see if we can work something out. And we may have to come back again in February when, President-elect Biden becomes President Biden to do more. But, we right now are experiencing as a result of this pandemic, a worsening of this crisis. It is really a scandal, and it is criminal that the federal government hasn't stepped up to the plate and provided relief. I mean, these are our fellow citizens who I don't even know where their next meal is going to come from. I've been at a number of food distribution sites, and the lines of people that come to get boxes of food or additional groceries to be able to supplement their diets for them and their families. It's unbelievable. We need to do better. And again, we need to increase the political pressure on our elected officials to make this a priority.
I remember when I ran Catholic Charities, one day having to step outside one of our food pantries and tell the dozens and dozens and dozens of people in line that we were out of food for the day and we weren't going to be able to give them any more food.
No.
And I think confronted with that once, you see the depth of it. How do we build this will to end this political condition you're talking about?
Yeah, well, I think part of the way is we need to remind people who are in positions of power what the real stories are. I mean, just like you were, deeply impacted by having to tell people we're out of food. I mean, I've been to places, I've seen hungry children in my own district. It breaks your heart. It doesn't have to be. And I would like to think that when people know the facts, then they will want to be part of an effort to find a solution. Again, we need to create the political will. We need to have people who stop beating up on poor people or struggling families and actually come to the aid of these families. Again, I remind people, the majority of people who are on federal assistance like SNAP who can work actually do work. They're doing everything right, everything we expect of them, and yet they still can't put food on the table on a regular basis for their families. we can fix that. I mean, there are things that we can do in the short term, a stimulus package. We can increase the SNAP benefit overall, but then we need a longer-term approach here, to solve this problem once and for all. And again, I always joke with I love the food banks, and I do an annual walk with Andrew Morales. We walk for 43 miles to raise money for the food bank of Western Massachusetts, which we do on the Monday and Tuesday before Thanksgiving. But I always joke with him. I mean, my goal in life is to put him out of business, so that we don't need to have food banks and food pantries to make sure that people have basic nutrition. We need to eliminate food deserts. We need to make sure people have access not just to food but to nutritious food. We need a food policy in this country. So there are things that we need to do and we need to focus on. And my hope is that maybe the political climate here will get a little bit better in the coming months.
That's Congressman Jim McGovern of the 2nd District. Thank you so much for your time today.
All the best and be safe.
Thank you. 400 years ago today, on November 11th, 1620, the Mayflower anchored in what is today Provincetown Harbor. Some of this year's formal celebrations are seeking to put the native tribes and nations that those settlers encountered and displaced at the center of the story after centuries of marginalization. Today we want to do the same by engaging with the history and present day of the Wampanoag people. We turn to Hartman Dietz. He is a member of and cultural resource monitor for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and an activist and historian. Hartman, so glad to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So help us paint a clearer picture of our collective history. What was life like in these parts 400 years ago?
Well, it's funny because you say collective history and then what was life like, because, there's this separation of the myth and the fact, and we have this shared history of a myth, but there's the fact of life for thousands of Wampanoag people and other Donland tribes of people, Pequot and Abenaki, Mi'kmaq folks, was that life was was a vibrant thing for folks, a society where people had trade networks and economies, people had trade agreements, people had their garden where they were attending to their farms, their kinship relations that they had to keep up, economic alliances, political alliances, war, strife, all the different things that are happening in any human civilization. And these things were all happening through the thousands and thousands of lives of people that lived here on a daily basis. And when the Mayflower landed, they were 50 souls amongst thousands that some people knew about, and many other people may not have even understood that it was happening. We're unaware of that this boat had landed on the coast. So this is a part of what we would see of the truth of society then. It was a very fate-changing moment for us, but not necessarily everybody was aware of the magnitude of what was going on.
Hartman, you talk about the vibrant trade networks, the economies. Let's talk about governance. So often the Mayflower Compact is looked at as this early founding document, helped create this new nation. It's central to this idea of self-governance as we think about it now. But people here had already been self-governing for thousands of years, had they not?
Oh, absolutely. The idea of self-governance was deeply seated in the principles of how people govern themselves and how people elected leadership in Native societies. And leadership was elected. Leadership was chosen by the people. And this is a concept that was relatively new in the monarchy system of European people. But for Native people, these concepts we're age old and just a part of life. The sovereignty of one community to be able to make the decisions for themselves versus making decisions for the village across the valley or across the river, it didn't exist. While there was districts where larger decisions were made and people might go to settle disputes between two villages when they might not be able to come to agreement, so there's this setup where there's larger districts with slimmer nations that might have figureheads that were more endowed with more power. they were all still elected by systems of clan mothers and different members of the communities that gave their power over to them by giving them their support.
It really is striking that you're talking about a history of elections on what we now call American soil for centuries prior to 1620, prior to when the settlers from Europe began to set up such systems here.
Well, it wasn't exactly elections. We had a word that was coming from our language, caucus. And it's something that you see in the primary still of many states, where people actually physically stand behind the leader that they support and the message that they're supporting. So we would have these lengthy debate sessions where people would be chosen to lead and sometimes lead for just a very short period of time for a particular matter. But these debates would go on and people would shift until there was an obvious overwhelming support for one candidate, for one choice of leader or another, where there didn't need to be a count, like we just saw with this recent election. You know, so many of these decisions were made on just a few margins, you know, very close races in many places. If the races were that close, if the decisions were that close, there wasn't a clear winner, because you had to have an overwhelming support of the people or reached a consensus, where you might have 70-80% of people backing one idea, one spokesperson. So this wasn't a simple majority rule. It was consensus rule, which is very different. And I think it's a better thing. You have to work harder to achieve it. But I think that the results are better than the simple majority rule where 51% wins.
We're talking with Hartman Dietz, a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and a cultural resource monitor and historian for the tribe. Let's go to the Mayflower moment. 1620, the Mayflower docks off Provincetown Harbor. It wasn't the first, wasn't the last ship of European origin to come here. But what was different? There was something different. I know that you've talked about this before.
Yeah, certainly. It was. They say that at the point when the Mayflower dropped anchor in Provincetown, it was not uncommon at any point in time to find nearly 200 ships between Jamestown, Virginia, and the coast of Maine. So the European ships had become very common up and down the coast, stopping, trading, sometimes taking captives and slaves, which certainly wasn't a part of what we appreciated and not a part of what earned them good reputation. In fact, quite the opposite. But you know, some folks would come and do trade. Some folks would come ashore and harvest resources. But they would move on. And these were largely vessels that were full of sailors and seamen. And what the Mayflower had that was different is had people that were unpacking their possessions, making a place to stay and live. They had women and children amongst them, families. Mm-hmm. They weren't here to trade and move on. They were here to make a new lives for themselves. And that was very different from anything that we had seen before.
What was the reaction?
Well, the reaction was cautious. When they landed out in Nauset, they were attacked because the folks out in Nauset had seen these slavers before and had been victims of the slavers. So that bad reputation I'd spoken of had really shaped their opinion of European vessels of all sorts. So they were attacked, you know, within the first landfall of when they first made landfall out in the Outer Cape. And that's part of why they came into Plymouth Harbor, was because of the hostility that they found out there. But when they came into Plymouth Harbor, a lot of the folks that had been there had passed on. So many folks that had passed on from the sickness that they said that bones were sitting above the soil to be, bleached by the sun and no one to bury them.
Can you clarify what you mean by the sickness, Hartman? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I get the sense this is important.
Just like we're seeing the COVID-19 now, 400 years ago, we also saw a sickness that came up the coast and wiped out whole villages at a time. And this had a really big impact on our society, the fabric of our society, much like, you know, think about Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina and how this whole society fractures and has to rebuild again from this monumental event. And it was a similar thing for us here as Wampanoag people to have to rebuild society after this plague had wiped out so many of our people. So we were in the midst of this catastrophe. And these folks showed up in a vacant part of our homeland where the village had been wiped out. And So some folks may have been watching closely from a distance, and they started trying to decide to figure out what their purpose, what their aim was here, what their ambition was. And we found people that could speak English, some folks that had been taken as slaves and brought back to go in and try to find out what they intended to do and how long they intended to be here. And when we found out that they intended to stay and make a life for themselves, we wanted to have certain agreements in place from them that allowed them to stay here in our nation, in our homeland, and agreements that they were willing to make, although weren't necessarily followed for very long.
So I'd like to, there's so much more that we could discuss about the history, but I want to make sure to leave time for the tribe today, too. It's 2020. As you noted, we have another global pandemic. We're in an economic downturn, political unrest. We are reckoning with systemic racism and our nation's history. How should we be thinking about the legacy of the Mayflower today?
You know, the Mayflower is you know, something that's, we've taught a mythology around the Mayflower, and it doesn't always reflect the truth of the history of the lives of these people. A lot of these people were seeking to restart a life. A lot of them thought they were going to be landing in Jamestown. I think that the economic incentive of the financiers who sent the boat across the water had other ideas in mind. They had reserved rights for this area for colonization from the crown. So it's not surprising that somehow they found people that were, they were going to drop off there, even if they didn't suspect as much when they got on board the boat across the ocean. But these folks and the history and their lives and the complexities that they brought are not necessarily reflected in the myth. And the myth is really put in place to create a justification for the foundation of white supremacy in this nation. And this isn't the truth and the fact of the people who came here. They didn't come here to create this erasure of indigenous people or a justification by which, by transfer of one place to live for 50 people, that gave permit for the taking of an entire continent and the removal of an entire people, which is oftentimes what the mythology is alluding to, that we are now supposed to disappear in the presence of a superior people. And you know, these myths don't serve to help unite humanity. They don't serve to really make us as a nation able to achieve our best, because our best is not that one people have everything to offer and everyone else should be subservient, but that we all have something to offer and everybody has something that makes us all better. So hopefully we can look at this myth and this telling and realize that the truth of what happened is that there's a people who made room for strangers amongst their land, because we are all truly human beings, and we all have these same human needs. And if we can learn to get along and agree with each other and respect the boundaries and the truths of the law of the land, then we can do all right. But as
Hartman,
long as
I'm going to have to stop you there.
Okay, well,
I'm sorry, but I love that right. We can do all right. Hartman Dietz is a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe, a cultural resource monitor for the tribe, an activist and a historian. I really appreciate you being on the show today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, Tatiana.